And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Top 10.
That's right, Garrett Watley. It is a special installment of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, a top 10 show.
Hooray! That's my favorites.
That's Dean Haglund down under. I'm Phil Lairness. And as promised for a long time, we are going to be discussing our all-time favorite comedy films, our top 10 comedy films. I don't know if it's favorite or the ones we think are best or a combination thereof. Yeah. Where do you come down on that?
Well, here's the thing. And, pulling up my first top 10 list, I then went back to watch some of these movies that were on because I hadn't seen them in a while. And then realizing how much comedy exists in the sociological context of the era that they were made. So what was a hilarious Cheech and Chong movie that I laughed at in high school is now just the story of two gentlemen, maybe with glaucoma, who need copious amounts of medical things to stay well. And so
let me stop you suddenly, right there. Let me stop you right there. No, because I have a distinction I want to be clear on. I never thought we would be talking about this around Cheech and Chong movies. But now that I think about it, I love the Cheech and Chong records.
Right.
The question is the context around the time. Is it that you have changed in this instance, or that the times have changed? For example, Arthur, the original Arthur with Dudley Moore, John Gielgud. What a funny movie. It's still at times a hilarious movie, great performances, touching, a very good movie in all ways. Contextually, it holds up. And I have not changed in a way that it's any less funny or any less good, except alcoholism, not so funny anymore.
Not so funny. So, and knowing his own personal life too, right? The more we know about the performer.
So that's
also...
Well, exactly. That can be a big thing. Like we were talking about Harvey Weinstein on a recent show and how his name might change the way you view these things. Roman Polanski, et cetera. But...
Does that take away from the comedy?
Yes, but it can. But it can. Obviously, alcoholism, not funny. And the illnesses associated with it, not funny. The fact that the star died of it, not funny. That's context changing.
But Foster Brooks.
But my point.
Foster Brooks is a drunk act. He is a sober guy doing a drunk guy.
Okay.
All
right. But my point is, Arthur's not funny for that reason, but that's a contextual change, not a me as a viewer has changed.
Right.
What about the Cheech and Chong, getting back to it? Is it because you don't find it funny anymore, or because you think just the times have changed and it's not funny anymore?
Well, see, this is the thing. Was it ever funny? Because then I go excitedly to show Patty my favorite Monty Python movies. And the dead stare that comes from her takes me aback, baffles me to go, was not Life of Brian, was not the Holy Grail, Monty Python movies hilarious, or now do they just seem odd and surreal? So it's hard to distinguish, have I changed or was it the times? So in that sense, because I think it was the times and not so much me. Instead of top 10, I do have top 10 movies, but I have my favorite comedies from each era, each decade, going all the way back to the silent film
okay,
era.
Okay, so that's great. I think that there is this discussion, though, especially with comedy, that if it lends itself towards what we're saying are the best comedies, and in some cases I will use that word, then it's because, in no small way, it's still as funny as it was when it first came out. And that is a major accomplishment. So I think, you know, comedy's fascinating because so in the eye of the beholder, so subjective. Mm-hmm. But so we will probably be discussing whether, you know, this film is what we would say artistically great. Is our estimation of it personal? Is it a favorite? Are we playing favorites, et cetera? So in that regard, let me ask you first a couple just rapid-fire questions on these lists that I'm fascinated about. Okay.
Okay.
How many Hugh Grant movies?
How many Hugh Grant movies? Zero. What the hell?
Wow. Because, I expected that because I knew how can you pick between Notting Hill, Love Actually, About a Boy. It's a Sophie's Choice, really.
Are you kidding me?
No, I bring this up because I do find, and I still find, Hugh Grant to be one of the truly great screen comedic performers. Especially of the last quarter century. Man. No, seriously. Watch Notting Hill. His work is tremendous. About a Boy is a genuinely great film. Now, it's not even the funniest movie he's in. But that's also because this was a movie about stuff. It was about a boy. But you know,
okay, so here's the problem with that.
Great book, brilliant screenplay. You know, gifted filmmaker. But anyway, but the point was, I went back and actually caught some of Love Actually this week on television. Dear God, it's horrible. And I never realized it was horrible. I would watch this every couple years. You know, it's a holiday favorite. Some parts are uncomfortable. Some parts are stupid. Some parts are... it's out and out offensive how bad this movie is. And, and again... In part, I've changed, but also, thank God, in part, the world has changed. And and anyway.
Well, okay, so I never thought Hugh Grant, I mean, humorous, but to more, he had a charm of a fellow who didn't care and almost seemed not invested, even in the reality.
But I think you're buying his publicity. He always spoke about that. His charm belied how much he did care. And the fact that he would always say things like that lets you know how much he did care. And he's deeply invested in these movies. And it underestimates how many people's careers around him, writers, directors, producers, other actors, are actually built upon the shoulders of how much he invested in these otherwise utterly disposable comedies.
Okay, so this then brings me to the next thing, the distinction.
Yeah, no, I mean, something... I'm not saying that he's the same as this kind of guy, but you know, like Chevy Chase, not a lot of great movies for Chevy Chase, but are we going to deny that he was a really gifted comedic performer? No, he was really gifted.
Right, but I don't think he had craft, and this is where we come down to something that maybe Hugh Grant practices in, because he's British trained and there is craft involved. There's craft in comedy.
And let's face it, if he can't act, he's not doing impromptu. He's not doing restoration. Right. He's not doing Sense and Sensibility. The man is an actor. So,
and to me, Chevy Chase was fearless in the way not only his approach to performing, but in his throwing his body around in physical comedy. That he was just going at it without any concern for his own safety, hence why addicted to painkillers later on in his life, because he so screwed up his body doing Gerald Ford pratfalls on SNL and stuff like that.
Okay, so
there's a fearlessness, and then there's craft, right? And so I think this distinction can be made all through the history when we see all these movies.
Well, now, so another serious question for you I'm curious about, because this is one that kind of tore me up. Do you have any Coen Brothers movies on your list? I don't want you to tell me which they are, but do you have any?
Boy, I came close.
Me too. Me too. I did not. And I want to point out that I don't think there's any more reliable comedic filmmakers over the last several decades. But what I ended up coming to, because I came close with a couple. I came close with Fargo. I especially came close with Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Absolutely.
Especially because that leads into a discussion of Preston Sturges's Sullivan's Travel title comes. But what I came down to is the Coen brothers almost create such a rich mixture, such a rich tapestry of different film styles and genres blended into something that is uniquely their own, that it almost it prevents them from being in the top of any of the genres. You know, like gangster film or anything else, like, or even a war film. I don't know if they did a war film, if it would be stand a chance in the top 10 war films, because it would be so uniquely a Coen Brothers war film.
Right, because it'd be so breathtaking in its scope. I mean, you think of Raising Arizona and just, you know, the comedic Holly Hunter in that, how funny she was in her love of the baby. And yet it had such deep resonance in the context of the rest of the movie that it almost undermined how funny it was, you know, that you put such pathos to it and all that, sort of ejected all that.
That's a major theme that's going to come out a lot of times in this, is movies that maybe didn't make my list because the takeaway is so painful from them. Does that mean they're not a great comedy? Of course not. But exactly what you're saying, if the takeaway is pathos, we'll talk about, I think, Wes Anderson at some point in this, and that's and that's directly at the heart of what I wanted to talk about with Wes Anderson. So you mentioned, I don't know if this is still true, but just you know, off the cuff, when we were recording last week's show, in between, you know, right before we got started, you mentioned that I think you had like a dozen films on your list. I would imagine with what we've already talked about, we're going to end up mentioning or discussing in some length
so
at least
many.
Like 30 movies, which is fantastic. But but you said you had maybe a dozen films with a couple more that were kind of honorable mention. If that's true, did you want to hit me with the honorable mention ones?
Well, I mean, we were discussing in terms of context how we change over the time. So I'll start in our present time, and I kind of will work backwards through history and the history of film to get back to perhaps my number one film, which would be something in the Chaplin genre anyway.
Okay.
Because that's where my head's at.
Right.
So let's start then.
Well, that's where everything kind of starts for you.
With Chaplin.
Yeah. And there is a degree to which where when things really start, maybe not the first movie we ever saw, of course, but where things really start to click for us, we often find ourselves coming back there. Because you can lose yourself so many times in creative work that it really behooves you to ground yourself time and time again in where you first found yourself. But
well, and particularly in comedy.
Yeah.
If you have never seen a silent comedy in a theater filled with people and to hear solid laughter, because you don't have to shut up to hear the next line of dialogue, you can just let that laughter roar.
So many times.
I have not seen enough silent comedies in a room full of people enjoying it. But the times I have, it has been jaw-dropping in the sheer amount of laughter that will come out of a group in not a two-hour movie, in a 20-minute, in a 15-minute short. There'll be more laughter than in most of today's present day comedies.
What what's the most recent honorable mention? You made it seem like there was one recent one,
right?
Older.
Well, I'm actually going with Deadpool 2 and / Deadpool. because to me, these two work in conjunction with each other. And this is the idea of decimating the tropes of all the comic book action movies that inundate our multiplexes these days. Then this is one of the very recurring themes you'll see through all of these movies, is a movie that mocks the tropes of the movies that it's purporting to be of the genre of.
Fascinating. Yeah. I mean, I never thought about it in the sense that of a genre parody, because parodies have become so broad, so grounded in no reality. And yet, remember when we did our Westerns show, I actually had Blazing Saddles as one of my top 10 favorite Westerns, because the damn thing is, it gave me all the thrills that I got from Westerns as a kid. It gave you the thrills. It didn't deny them. And that's true of Deadpool. It gives you the comic book thrills.
At the same time, mocking the very thing and breaking the fourth wall and all of the things that a comedy should do, that should undermine, that should bash away at tropes, at things that are held self-important within the genre. Deadpool does a job of diminishing that and highlighting the hollowness that the Emperor has no clothes, as it were.
That's truly honorable. That's a great to mention it. That is truly honorable. My most recent, I have two honorable mentions as well. And my most recent honorable mention, and I honestly can't tell you why it's not on my list, other than it's just not on my list. But it's a movie that I thought was shockingly underappreciated at the time, though it got an Oscar nomination for screenplay, won Best Song. But it's so funny. It's the best work that's ever been done by director Curtis Hanson, who's no longer with us, by screenwriter Steve Kloves, who adapted Michael Chabon's book. It's the best work ever by Michael Douglas. It features a luminous Frances McDormand, the best work by Tobey Maguire, the best work by Robert Downey Jr. Young Katie Holmes is entrancing. Rip Torn is downright elemental. Even Richard Thomas delivers one of the great hilarious performances of all time. And Alan Tudyk is unforgettable. I'm talking about Wonder Boys. It's one of the most literary, literate, moving ensemble comedies. Michael Douglas's performance is worthy of the Pantheon, and yet it's not on my top 10 list, and I don't know why. So let's put it on honorable mention.
That's an honorable mention. Well, that's fascinating, because I, you know what? I'm not even sure I've seen the whole thing, because I didn't know if I found it funny, per se.
It's so funny from the get-go. It is just so Tobey Maguire in a writing class at a college. His professor, who's written one successful novel, is a dope fiend. And what the other students say about his work, Tobey Maguire's work, is so funny. But I could also see that opening scene, Dean Haglund going to an art school. It could have made, could have been a little painful. I've seen how you are when you see people street busking. You get sympathy pains that would beat the band.
Left, right, center.
Yeah. So, what's your other honorable mention?
You know, it's got to be, Bill Murray to me, one of the great comedic voices of our time. And there's so many movies that he's done that has brought joy to the world. And yet, what's the one, Bill Murray comedic element that saves a movie that otherwise is not bad? It's got to be, for my mind, it's Caddyshack. Because that holds Bill Murray, even though Ted Knight's brilliant in it, and Roddy Dangerfield, you got all these comedic elements. It's a very funny golf movie, which I have no relation to whatsoever, really. But it's an honorable mention only insofar as that I think Bill Murray wasn't on my list. Nothing stood out as a Bill Murray ensemble, and the Wes Anderson Bill Murray movies that I like so much. all of them seem to cancel each other out in terms of my list of favorites. So Caddyshack comes in.
I'm gonna. Bill Murray's gonna be on my list, and so we'll talk about Bill Murray a little bit more. My other honorable mention, going well back in time, Ernst Lubitsch, who one of the greats, obviously, especially of comedy, but only because I finally watched it for the first time not that long ago, and immediately for it to be this close to inclusion lets you know how much I loved it. But I've only seen it once, and I've seen it so recently that I didn't think it was fair to include it over some of these films that have stood such a long personal test of time for me.
Right.
And that was To Be or Not to Be with Jack Benny. But I was struck by not only how funny it was and how well it worked, but how funny it was and how well it worked given my innate familiarity with the film, because of course when I was a kid my grandmother took me to see the Mel Brooks remake, and right. so I knew scene for scene the whole story, and yet right. this original is so funny, and Jack Benny, by God, what a performance. And Carol Lombard, I mean, what a gifted comedian. There's nothing better than a great comedian. So
it's very rare to have a World War II Nazi threat comedy work as well as that does.
Speak for yourself. All right. So I guess that brings us to our list then, doesn't it?
I guess that's our list. Though again, my list will be
Why don't you start the list then?
Well, then number 10 would be I'm going backwards in time then. And then I'm not even sure of when these things are released compared to each other. But let's say on my number 10, I'm going to go a Judd Apatow movie starring Steve Carell, kind of a breakout thing. And this is The 40-Year-Old Virgin. To me, it's an original story of a guy who's a virgin working at a TV store. You got amazing performances. You see Seth Rogen, Paul Rudd, you know, all the gang, all the Judd Apatow regulars. And to me, again, this is the difference between Deadpool and Deadpool 2 is clearly some improvisational elements going on, but that the energy just bubbles off the screen. It's not forced. Every scene almost seems to naturally evolve out of itself with mirth, lightness, humor. And it is a great example of a film comedy that has craft and yet this throwaway attributes to it that I think are so essential in everything in my entire list.
So it's some of the things we were talking about when we were talking about Solo, recently. This is so well constructed, the gags, as you would say, and yet allows for the improvisation within it. Because the editing is superb. It's perfectly honed. This is, by the way, for those people who've seen the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling, they'll know this is the movie that Gary Shandling most had his hands on for Judd Apatow.
Oh, I did not know that.
Right down to the ending. You know, he would keep pressing him in a way, and this is my own language, but this is the job of any storyteller, right, in film. You are trying to show the audience how the world looks and sounds to the characters whose story we are following. You are trying to convey what that world looks like, sounds like, and therefore feels like to these characters. And Gary Shandling really held Apatow's feet to the flame on this, especially... what comes out of that is the terrific ending of what do you do when it's time for the virgin to have sex? How do you depict that? And that is one of the most breathtaking sequences in any movie. And it's so brilliant. It's so outside of the box. And it was so entirely Gary Shandling's idea.
Wow. I didn't know that. Well, that makes me like this movie all the more, for crying out loud.
Because Judd Apatow, the mentorship that Chandling offered him was everything. Number 10 would have been Blazing Saddles, which we talked about. But because I try, when we do these genre crackdowns, I try not to repeat from one list to another. You know, if I've said that it's one of my top 10 favorite Westerns, then I should go in a different direction. And so I thought for a while, well, do I go in the Mel Brooks direction? Do I replace it with The Producers? Which is such a wonderful script and such wonderful performances. But I decided what I wanted to honor was what you were talking about, which is, you know, the puncturing of genre tropes. Call it parody if you want. And so I went with perhaps not the funniest film or work by the team of David and Jerry Zucker and Jim Abrams, but by the one that is completely the best constructed, and that is Airplane, released in 1980, starring Robert Hayes, Julie Haggerty, and featuring Leslie Nielsen and Robert Stack and Lloyd Bridges and Peter Graves in performances that would reinvent all of them, plus a whole bunch of cameos that have become iconic, like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Yeah. I guarantee you there's a whole lot of us, when we think of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, maybe we think of basketball, but 1A is we're thinking of him in Airplane. It is a parody of the disaster film genre, obviously, particularly the 1957 Paramount film Zero Hour, of which it is an official remake. They bought the rights to it, and every single straight line in that movie is from Zero Hour.
Which is how you want to do a parody.
Exactly.
You have to have
perfectly constructed.
Perfectly constructed it, and then the gags pop off of that. Boy, do they pop off of Airplane. I mean, think about just not just the repeatability and how many of those gags have went into common vernacular, but also Leslie Nielsen's career. You wouldn't have any Naked Gun 33 and a third or any of the entire series and the second half of Leslie Nielsen's career if it wasn't for this movie.
So it's also important to know that this was a huge genre at the time. I mean, Airport 75 was, which was a sequel to Airport and was a huge hit when they went into
all the disaster
production
movies
on this. And so Airplane, not only a critical success, surprisingly, because of all the slapstick and the visual and the verbal puns, right? It may be surprising what a critical success it was, but such a financial success, budgeted at $3.5 million, and only would Paramount greenlight that budget if the venerable old Howard Koch, who was responsible for Casablanca, only if he would supervise as producer. And it goes on to make $83 million in North America against that $3.5 million budget. It was nominated for Golden Globe and Writers Guild Awards for Best Screenplay, for crying out loud. It ranked, I think, sixth on Bravo's 100 Funniest Movies of All Time. It was second by Channel 4 in the UK of Greatest Comedies of All Time after Life of Brian, which you mentioned. It's on like all these lists, and of course is on the you gotta love that Airplane was deemed by Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant.
I know
that's just
that
as
amazing?
Funny as anything in the movie itself. Number 10, Airplane, and don't leave off the exclamation mark. And by the way, one of the greatest gags in any advertising campaign ever comes in the sequel, or not in the sequel, but in the Zucker Brothers follow-up, Top Secret, which also had an exclamation mark at the end.
Right.
And which was a parody of the Airplane poster, because the airplane in the Airplane poster was tied in a knot. So the Top Secret, it's the cow costume that some of the spies are wearing, and it's tied in a knot and flying through space. And then it says underneath the title, Top Secret, it says an asterisk or from the makers of the original Airplane, because there had been a sequel to Airplane that you shouldn't watch unless you're a William Shatner fan, because it was made by a different team. But it said from the makers of the original Airplane, and then there was an asterisk. And when you go below the billing block in really small print on the posters, the asterisk says, not the Wright brothers.
That's anyway. Funny.
All right. What's your number nine, Dean Haglund?
Number nine, I think you and I have watched it when we shared offices side by side. You know, when you think about individual voices in comedy coming through and knowing their own work method, Trey Parker and Matt Stone know their stuff when they do Team America, World Police, a mockery of all the action films, all Michael Bay stuff, and done with puppets, no less. It holds as a comedy. It holds as an action. You know, all those tropes are identified in there and tried. They tried to do them. Really well done. The characters are hilarious. And you got hilarious musical soundtrack to it, too, which the, you know, the South Park guys are known for. So
talk about
Team America, World Police.
Talk about improvisation. I mean, Parker and Stone had this competition with each other, right? They were improvising,
yeah,
and they would each pay each other based on who could get the camera operator to laugh first. Whoever could make the camera operator blow a take would win money that day. What I also love is it, you know, how you were saying Deadpool mocks the tropes while still giving you the thrills. Blazing Saddles does that. Young Frankenstein does that, right? With
that's on my list.
But spoiler alert. But and I think Young Frankenstein was on my horror film list, which is why it wasn't eligible for this. But anyway, the thrills that and I grant you that this is for maybe a small percentage of an audience, depending on when you grew up. But for those of us who were big fans of shows like The Thunderbirds,
yes,
we got those thrills. We got our big budget Thunderbirds movie, and it wasn't the Thunderbirds movie. It was Team America, World Police.
Yeah, because they were, you know, the sets that they created. I mean, the Paris set, the Mount Rushmore hidden base, all of that was really well done. I mean, as comedic and mockery, you would think, well, I don't think that, but I know some people go, oh, if we're making fun of it, we don't really have to invest in production design on it. We don't really have to go all out and building these models and these sets and these puppets. But in fact, it's the opposite is true. You really have to make it almost better than in order for that comedy to land. Because if it's all poorly done, you can't really relax into the joke as it goes.
My number nine is a film I promised you, Bill Murray. And it is a film that, again, the Library of Congress selected for preservation in 2015. And the American Film Institute named it the 28th greatest comedy of all time. So these are some august bodies right there.
Right.
And I think the success of this film maybe overshadows what a landmark comedically this was, where an entire generation of comedians and comedy talent put it all together. And that's 1984's Ghostbusters.
Oh, really?
Directed and produced by Ivan Reitman, written by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis, originally written to be a John Belushi vehicle. So here we are again, like we talked about with Deadpool 2, when we were talking about what happens when an actor takes over a role. Sometimes that's the perfect thing. Because what Bill Murray brings to the world of Ghostbusters, and looking back at it now, the attitude he's expressing to the entire genre of blockbuster entertainment that was officially here to stay with Ghostbusters. Think about it. It's Ghostbusters that proves the methodology that every movie needs to be a franchise blockbuster. And right. the approach that Bill Murray takes to this world that's being destroyed, you can say by ghosts, you can say by Gozer the Gozerian, but really it's by the reality of the hell that this movie itself will call forward. The approach right. that Bill Murray takes of shoulders back, deadpan, and always quick with a quip, because we laugh so that we may not cry, so that we may not wet ourselves. it is the hero for the modern age, honestly.
Right.
I am reminded of so many scenes in the film that are not about the big action sequences, not about the big explosions, not about the big effects, although they're all fantastic. But moments like Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis, you know, explaining to Ernie Hudson about what they're facing, and using one of those scientific comparisons that I always love, where it's the size of this many football fields, right? Like, I know what the size of a football field is, but it's the but take that Twinkie and imagine a Twinkie 800 feet long, and right. And so then Bill Murray comes in, says how things are going, and Ernie Hudson, still freaked out, says, "Tell him about the Twinkie." And quite concerned, Bill Murray looks at Dan Aykroyd and says, "What about the Twinkie?" And it's this kind of both deadpan, shoulders back, slack-jawed, yet nevertheless playing it straight.
Playing
that,
it straight.
That we need more of, not less of.
Absolutely. And it's a throwaway. And I had read that, you know, he agreed to do this so that he could do the movie he really wanted to do, which was Razor's Edge.
Absolutely.
That came out almost immediately after. And in doing this, he sort of threw it all away. And that throwing away gives lines like, you know, in the library, "Oh, no human would stack books like this." Like, it is, there's no way that was written. It's had to be improvised. He couldn't care less if it was cut in or out.
It's something he learned, I think, on the set of Tootsie, really, because Columbia first brought him in before they brought him in to replace Belushi and Ghostbusters. They bring him in on the strength of the huge success of Stripes to save Tootsie, to literally save it, not from the standpoint of a performance, but the standpoint of a set that was in mutiny. A set where actors and directors hated each other, where nobody got along. And they really asked Bill Murray, "Can you come in to play this part to just revive everyone's spirits?" And the role he found for himself as an actor was one who, while everyone's freaking out all around him, would give just that much less.
And he did the same on Meatballs. Meatballs was a movie, a mess of a
not always
summer camp.
Not always. You're thinking you're giving revisionist history. Think about his pep talk. Think about his pep talk in Meatballs. He was famous for his energized pep talks.
Oh yeah.
Much like in Stripes. So this was
that's true.
This was something he had discovered in Tootsie. Anyway, I told you we would talk about Bill Murray. We did. There Ghostbusters, my number 9. What's number 8, Dean Haglund?
Number 8, let's see, that would be parodying the horror genre from a British standpoint. It's Simon Pegg in Shaun of the Dead. Ah, how I love this movie. Also, not just because a parody of horror movies and zombie movies, but of British culture, of the droning day-to-day drudgery of working that you can't tell the difference between you're working stiff and a zombie stiff as the zombie apocalypse happens around Simon and his friend Nick, and how they just want to hang out and go to a pub and relationship problems. So much of Shaun of the Dead is so fresh, so innovative. Ending, I can live without, but overall Shaun of the Dead to me brings so many fresh, funny ideas, and kicks off the career for so many people off that movie.
I would say it's not a parody, and here's where I would say that it's not a parody, because it's definitely a zombie comedy, and it pokes fun, but the issue is this. Blazing Saddles comes along, I think Deadpool comes along, Airplane comes along, at a time when these tropes are no longer saying anything of relevance to culture, to society. And it's just puncturing the balloon at that point. And but Shaun of the Dead does the nifty trick of making it funny while at the same time restoring the social satire elements that always made zombie movies great in the first place. Night of the Living Dead is one of the most politically subversive movies that's ever been made. And Romero's zombie movies often were that. They were social satire. And that's the piece that had gone missing. So it's a comedy, but it actually, instead of parodying it, I feel it restores the soul of the zombie genre to zombie movies. That's just...
That's fascinating because you laugh so much through it. You don't think that much laughter would be holding in restoring a horror genre. But it's true, actually. Now that you say that, by putting that in, that is a very clever trick. You know, I had done a convention with Nick Frost, and he totally remembered. I said, you know, I almost met you once at Comic-Con in San Diego. I was late checking out of my hotel room, and so I had to run, but I was wearing a Shaun of the Dead t-shirt that somebody had went to your panel and you handed out free t-shirts, and then I was wearing it because somebody gave it to me at my table, and you guys were all at the bar going, hey, that's our movie. And I so regretted not turning around and hanging out with you guys. And he goes, yeah, you were the first person we saw at the con wearing our t-shirt, and we were so thrilled. And then one of the guys in their drinking crew sort of recognized me, and it was like, my one big regret wasn't turning around and sitting with them and having all my luggage then thrown out in the street at the hotel. That would have been the trade-off.
I always thought that was your biggest regret when you were naked and drunk in that hallway in Las Vegas was not turning around.
No,
anyway,
no. That's a fantastic story now.
Number 8 on my list is Wes Anderson. I just have Wes Anderson as number 8. I think he's the most gifted comedic filmmaker. There are some great ones. Alexander Payne. We mentioned the Coen brothers, but I think Wes Anderson is the most unique comic voice working today. And to me, the two the two mountaintops that he achieves are at this point Royal Tenenbaums and Grand Budapest Hotel. They're both wonderfully literate. They're both wonderfully theatrical. They use great stage technique, and they are also incredible illustrations of cinematic history.
Right.
And I wasn't sure which one to do. The Royal Tenenbaums is 2001, directed by Wes Anderson and stars Gene Hackman in really a career-capping performance.
Totally.
Great work from the entire ensemble, Gwyneth Paltrow, Bill Murray, Ben Stiller. Ben Stiller is actually really touching, surprisingly. At the end of this movie, he comes out of nowhere and is touching. And it has so many. It's about how you do this. It's ostensibly based on a non-existent novel, told with a narrative that was influenced obviously by J.D. Salinger, and it follows the lives of three gifted siblings who experience great success in youth, greater disappointment and failure when they're grown up, and how their eccentric and estranged father leaves them when they're young, only to return to them after they've grown, trying to make amends. That's the basic plot line. But its cinematic influences include Louis Malle's The Fire Within and Orson Welles' The Magnificent Ambersons. It's absurdist. Right. It's ironic. And the reason I wasn't sure whether to have that or Grand Budapest Hotel, and I'm still not sure, is because Grand Budapest Hotel is actually funnier. But the Grand Budapest Hotel is also much more sad. I mean, the Ralph Fiennes in the Grand Budapest Hotel, this comedy film about a concierge in old Europe, war-torn Europe, embodying this this ethos of a bygone age. He is so funny all the time, no matter what he is facing. And yet, as layer after layer of this fragmented flashback narrative are revealed, it just gets more and more painful and becomes more and more about loss and sorrow and mourning and the death of better times. And so,
I don't know which is the better comedy. I put Wes Anderson in the Coen brothers category in terms of a brilliant filmmaker writing and directing such complex, layered, heartfelt, emotional stuff that the comedy itself doesn't stand alone as a comedy more, but it stands as a tapestry, a rich tapestry.
Well, I would say, I think the only genre he's in is comedy. That's the difference between him and the Coen brothers. The Coen brothers are always merging many different genres. But you think about anything in Wes Anderson films, even when he drops into action territory, Steve Zissou, Life Aquatic. You know, it's done comedically. It's always done comedically. It's just that his worldview, especially as he has matured, he has become a mature man. The wistfulness has emerged into a mournfulness and a sorrowful nature. There is just beneath these glittering and delightful surfaces of contrived artifice, there is such genuine soul beneath these films.
That it's
hard for me to separate them. Anyway, so Wes Anderson is my number 8.
I even think of him as his own genre, frankly. Yeah. Like a Wes Anderson film stands out.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Awesome.
Number 7.
Wherever number we are on.
7.
we go to, as I said earlier, Monty Python. Some of it not resonating with Patty, but one that I was rewatching as I was rewatching all of them still holds up in my head, and that's The Meaning of Life. Some of these standalone sketches, it's just a series of sketches, not really a fully developed narrative, but then again, nothing in Monty Python ever really was, maybe Life of Brian, but holy smokes. The musical number of Every Sperm is Sacred. John Cleese as the sex ed teacher in the parochial private school, the private British boys school, showing the kids how to properly have sex by demonstrating on his wife in front of the class. So many, and of course, the outlandish vomiting scene and surreal element. I mean, fish with the wide angle lens. Good Lord, what happened? What surreal thing? And yet I still, there's something so surreal about that sketch that makes me laugh to go, how did that even get filmed? It adds to the surreality that Monty Python brought because of the diverse writing of the six of them that somehow melded together.
You know,
it's
interesting because I always have found their funniest and therefore my favorite to be Holy Grail. And much like with the Zucker brothers and Jim Abrams, their funniest and therefore my favorite was always Top Secret. But I do acknowledge, apropos of this conversation of favorite versus best, that Airplane's better. And it's better because craft and structure matter, and they will tell you that. And with Monty Python and the Holy Grail, it was to me at its best, because it's roughly at the same time, by the way, it was these sword movies, these epic sword movies, right? Mythology movies, what Blazing Saddles was to Westerns. And
for sure.
Right down to kind of borrowing the ending, the abrupt ending of Holy Grail is kind of borrowed out of Mel Brooks, but
yeah,
Mel Brooks was a more accomplished filmmaker and screenwriter. And the structure of Blazing Saddles does not let you down. And it does at times let you down in Holy Grail, because they could not escape what they fundamentally were, which were sketch writers, directors, performers. And therefore, it kind of makes sense that Meaning of Life is where they bring it all together perfectly, because they embrace that which they most truthfully are, which are these creators of sketches. And by then, of course, as you point out, the cinematic surrealism of a Terry Gilliam is in full flourish.
Right. Everybody has now, found their rhythm, found their thing they do, as it were, that then they can let blossom. And amazingly, all of them lets each other blossom. You would think that by this time, egos you've heard would try and crush and clash. And yet somehow it holds an equilibrium that allows these different comedic elements to come forward. I don't know how that possibly lasted this long. It was really quite a phenomenal thing for any comedy group.
My number seven also hails from those sceptered islands in the North Atlantic. It's a Scottish comedy from 1983, written and directed by Bill Forsyth, who at the time seemed like he was going to be really one of the all-time great masters. He did end up having a handful of films to his credits that stand the test of time, like Gregory's Girl, though he did not end up having the career that many people envisioned for him, a career equal to, let's say, Billy Wilder or Woody Allen, one of those prolific comedic greats. But this one is Local Hero, and it stars Peter Riegert, Denny Lawson, Fulton McKay, Burt Lancaster. You talk about what is the job of a supporting actor. Oh, my God. Burt Lancaster gives you everything you could possibly need, both to believe the world you are watching and to undercut the world you are watching. It also features in an utterly charming supporting performance, an early performance by, and a completely boyish Peter Capaldi, for crying out loud. It is about an American oil company representative who is sent to the fictional village of Furness. He goes from Houston to this rural area on the west coast of Scotland to purchase the town and the surrounding property for his company so that they can build a refinery there. And so many machinations are created to stave off what they know will be a tooth-in-nail fight to preserve the beauty and the cultural uniqueness as well as the ecological fragility of the area. What a battle they're going to have. And they don't realize that every single member of that town can't wait to get the hell out. Just show us some money and we'll sell it. So the conflict is one that neither side understands doesn't exist in the first place.
Yeah. And, that's fantastic.
And I love movies.
I've seen this.
I love movies where the location is a character. And and you get to really get a sense of a time, a place, a way of life, and what the rural versus the urban lifestyles do to us. It's a brilliant character comedy. It's charming. It's mystical. There's magic in it. There's romance. It is as funny as movies get. It's Local Hero. My number seven.
Fantastic. Well, let's see. Now we come to something. This was going in and out of my list, but, I often talk about performances, comedic performances in terms of craft, in terms of character, but rarely do we talk about fearless commitment to character. And I bring up Sacha Baron Cohen's Borat, and his character, The Cultural Learnings of America to Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan, and how he, you know, it finds out later that maybe not all of it was actual improvisation, but that a lot of it improvised, that he stays in character long after the uncomfortableness comedic moment is passed. He does it for $18 million, rakes in $261 million off of this thing. It is an outlier. No other mockumentaries try to do the same thing. He tried to do the same thing with other characters, the dictator and that sort of thing, couldn't match it. This thing is sort of like Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club album, that it just comes out, it changes everything, and yet it's unreplicated. And because it's so such an outlier, is it, you know, it's amazing, and yet it's unbelievable.
When Sacha Baron Cohen is at his best, one could argue when most brilliant comedians are at their best, it's because they're playing it the most real, right?
Yes.
One of the things I say in acting class to my students is, in drama, you have high stakes. What makes comedy is you play the stakes even higher.
That's right.
And one of the advocates that taught, that mentored Sacha Baron Cohen to play things more real, whose fingerprints are all over the movie Borat, is Gary Shandling.
Ah, is that right?
Again, we have no Judd Apatow. We have no Sacha Baron Cohen if we do not have what Gary Shandling gave them, the doors he opened to them. Fascinating.
Is this
huh?
in the documentary as
yes.
well?
Yes.
I cannot find this documentary down here.
Well, there you go.
I don't know.
HBO. It's an HBO documentary. It's on Home Box Office.
Yes. So, well, that gets corrupted down here in a big way. So
everything
I'll
gets
have
corrupted,
to find it.
Dean. Everything I love gets corrupted. And that's the comedy. That's the comedy of
yeah,
it. All right.
The comedy.
I my problems with this movie are all about it from the directing standpoint, from the filmmaking standpoint, right? And it inspires me. Nevertheless, this is why I bring it up, is not to knock it, but what I think, again, is all too often forgotten on the part of filmmakers, and it's easy to forget it because we now live in the social media world where you're expected, I guess, or you think you're expected to express your opinion, your snap opinion on things. But
right.
I wanted to love Borat. I found it hugely funny. And so therefore it bothers me, just as like how Skyfall, right? I love James Bond.
Yeah.
I love Daniel Craig. I'm loving what they're doing with this movie artistically, and then all of a sudden Bond rapes a woman, and I'm going, wait a minute, this guy, how are we all okay with this? And so then
right.
the wheels start turning, and the result ends up being the Lady Killers, right? With Borat, I love Sacha Baron Cohen. I loved his TV work. I find it funny. The movie's hilarious. We're following him in a wrestling match with Ken Davishian. The girthy Ken Davishian. And
yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, they go from wrestling naked in a hallway, and they bust into a convention center hall, still wrestling naked. And I suddenly sit up in my seat going, wait a minute. How come a camera was already set up in the convention hall
yeah.
to capture them? At that moment, it stopped believably being a documentary. And,
I know.
And of course, in the back of your mind, you know it's always fake. But the idea is we go to these movies hoping that we'll have those magical experiences of believing that we are seeing real people saying things and responding to things that are real. And so I'm asking myself in that moment, wait a minute. Couldn't they have done this in a way that with just more planning could have preserved this magic trick? Because that's what it is. It's a magic trick.
And, it's a magic trick for sure.
And that was the first birth from my end of my movie, Karl Rove, I Love You. Dan had been working on ideas about a satire about Karl Rove as the great, supporting character in DC, and the parallels between him and his own life as the unknown known supporting actor in Hollywood, and the way we get distracted by the person in the spotlight, and we do so at our own peril. But I'd been already thinking up ideas of how, if I ever did a fictional documentary or what was being called a mockumentary, how would I approach it? So when Dan comes to me and says, hey, I'm thinking about doing this as a mockumentary, could you maybe help me find a documentarian who would be willing to play themselves, much like in real life Dick Cheney did for George W. Bush when George W. Bush said, hey, would you help me come up with a list of potential vice presidential candidates? Like Dick Cheney did, I submitted a list with one name. And it was me, because I'd been working on these ideas based on that moment in... So that's the thing is, you know, we get out of these conversations of good, bad, and, you know, and this moment of great inspiration for me is coming in this movie that I'm really enjoying, and then something for me goes wrong. And and then I take that inspiration and I go on and work on it.
Well, and I think that's the analogy to the Sgt. Pepper's album, right? That it wasn't everybody's favorite, but it was so inspirational in terms of what you could do in the album, concept album.
And there are moments, and we remember moments.
Right.
And there are moments in Sgt. Pepper, right? Not necessarily songs, but moments. You're right, with Borat. My number six, and I'm going to suggest, because we're an hour in, I'm going to suggest that we save the second half of our list and turn this into a two-parter.
Let's do that.
I'm finding this fascinating. I hope our listeners are as well. But I'm going to
wait until we get into silent film.
We don't have to wait, because I'm going to set the stage for that right now.
Okay.
You had said that you were going backwards in time, but I would point out to you that Borat is the most recent of these movies that you've mentioned. So
no,
you've been jumping.
Virgin came before. Is it?
But Borat is the 2000s, and you had worked your way all the way back to the early 80s with Meaning of Life, only to bounce back into the...
Oh, yeah. So, well, I said it was an outlier. That's what I meant.
All right. emphasis on liar, which you are, because you didn't do what you said you were going to do. my number six...
Wait, are we cutting the? Is this where we're
yeah,
separating?
This is where we'll cut, because you just did your number six, so I'm doing my number
six. Okay, so then this is welcome back to the show.
No, we're finishing up a show right now.
So that way we're
saving half. See, half of 10 is five.
Five is half.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And so we'll each do our top five. And this is a great way to stop, I think, because I'm going to be bringing up that at which you are expert, and that is the silent comedy. And I am going to say that I do not have City Lights on this. And I'm sure we will talk about City Lights. We'll certainly talk about Chaplin. I have seen City Lights in the Los Angeles Theater, the very venue that was built to show City Lights. And I have seen it in a sold out house with my young goddaughter, and delighted in not only everyone else laughing, but at that time, an African-American gal in her single digits, transfixed by what's going on screen and laughing, right?
Isn't that amazing? You would think that
her life experience in modern age, her life experience based on her ethnicity, on being in a big city, technology, all these things could not be further removed than what is going on screen in City Lights. And she's transfixed and dying with laughter and moved by the movie. It's not on my list, though, and it's not on my list largely because who am I to talk about Chaplin in the face of your expertise at it, but also because... I almost forget how funny it is because of how crushingly moving it is to me.
Yes.
For me,
oh my God.
My favorite of the silent comics, my favorite of the silent filmmakers, one of my favorite filmmakers ever is Buster Keaton. I find him to be so modern, both in terms of the way he used film technique, but also as a performer, I find him to be modern. I find him almost to be the Bill Murray of his age.
Absolutely.
But instead of The General, which I will acknowledge is one of the greatest films ever made, and maybe my favorite movie he ever made, my favorite comedy he made was Sherlock Jr.
Oh, really?
Yes. 1924. And this is a story about a poor young projectionist that wants to marry the girl. He has an interest in being a detective. And when he falls asleep, he dreams of being Sherlock Jr., the world's greatest detective. His dreams and how he's able to go up on screen would not only inspire Woody Allen's terrific Purple Rose of Cairo, but also inspire him to solve real life conflicts in the movie that enable him to win the girl. It's got, I mean, the chase sequences, the action sequences, the set pieces are all everything you would expect from Buster Keaton. But I love my comedy, character based comedy, and it's my favorite character that Buster Keaton played.
Right. It's so brilliant. And so heartwarming, because here he is trying really hard to solve the crime. His earnest notepad. He does earnest really well. You think as a deadpan comedian that it would be emotionless, but in fact, so much emotion comes over from him not smiling. You call it the great stone face, but it conveys so many levels of heartfelt emotion that it always surprises me every time I watch it.
Well,
I love it.
I also would point out, and you probably will know this, we're 67 minutes in to this episode. We're going to end here. But I think our 67-minute episode, if I'm not mistaken, is significantly longer than the running time of Sherlock Jr.
Yeah, I think it is. I think
it is a
what is the
it's a very
45 minutes. It's a five reeler.
It's as short as a feature film possibly could be, and yet does it not feel fully filled in and satisfying and just packed full?
Packed full. No moment. There's no wastage. There's no establishing shots of taking forever to walk to him in the projection booth, all of that stuff.
This guy was capable of the long take, the slow burn, the epic of The General. He also was a master at economy of scale when it came to performance, emotion, editing, the gag. He could really run the gamut. And you compare, Sherlock Jr. and The General, what range? What range as a filmmaker, if not as an actor? And maybe that's one of the reasons that he hasn't been as popular throughout history, I guess, as Chaplin, is that he seemingly doesn't have the range of Chaplin as an actor. But as a filmmaker, he was a master.
Yeah, for sure. Amazing.
So
awesome.
That brings us to the end of part one of our sudden two-part installment all about our all-time top comedy films. We'll be back next week, I guess, with part two. I'm Phil Lernes.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Top 10. Guests of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn.
In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.